Hey, good afternoon, Juno. It's just a few seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore going to be your host today for the Juneau Afternoon Show. We'll be talking with Kristen Knutson-Lombardo here shortly about the upcoming ORCA programming and events that are scheduled for right away. Mark Piotrowski will come over. He's going to talk about Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive that's going on. Michael McBride, the author of a new book called The Last Wilderness, will be joining us. Darren Snyder will come in to tell us about the just before Mother's Day plant sale that will be held tomorrow morning out at the Safeway parking lot. And Juno Jazz and Classics artist Nikki Hill will join us near the end of the show with a preview of her performances tonight and tomorrow. Stay tuned for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. There's new evidence challenging the long-contested murder convictions of four Native men in Alaska. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the information was provided to the court in an effort to free the men known as the Fairbanks Four.
The documents provide further evidence that others are guilty of the 1997 beating death of Fairbanks teenager John Hartman. The information was provided by the Alaska Innocence Project. The group is seeking to reverse the convictions of George Freese, Kevin Peace, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent. The centerpiece of the new documents is a memo from a guard at a California prison where a former Fairbanks resident is jailed for life for other murders. The memo details a 2011 conversation between the guard and inmate William Holmes, who says he and a group of friends, not the Fairbanks Four, randomly targeted Hartman on a downtown street. Alaska Innocence Project Director Bill Oberle says the memo validates what Holmes later stated to the project in a sworn affidavit. Fairbanks Police Chief Laren Zager is suspect of any information from a convicted murderer. The state must file its response to requests for post-conviction relief for the Fairbanks Four by May 15th. For National Native News, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
The leader of the Assembly of First Nations stepped down last week. Dan Karpinchuk reports that Canada's largest First Nations organization is currently being run by an executive committee.
Sean Atleo stepped down as the Assembly of First Nations National Chief a week ago. Chiefs will meet in Ottawa in about 3 weeks to decide when to hold a vote for a new leader. Until then, the national executive of the AFN will conduct the organization's business, including what to do about Bill C-33, the First Nations Education Act. It was the controversy over that act and the diverse opinions from Native leaders across the country that led Atleo to resign. He had said he didn't want to be a distraction in the debate over the bill. For now, the AFN's regional chief from Quebec, Ghislain Picard, will act as spokesman.
We find ourselves under very exceptional circumstances, given that our national chief, Sean Atleo, has resigned last Friday. A first, a precedent in the Assembly of First Nations history. I think it's no secret or mystery that there are different point of views with regards to Bill C-33.
In one of its first announcements, the executive issued a statement acknowledging Atleo's efforts to achieve change for First Nations. The chiefs said his commitment and dedication on behalf of First Nations education were unwavering throughout his career. Meanwhile, the government has put the controversial First Nations Education Act on hold until the AFN determines its next move. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Santa Fe Indian Market is one of the best-known destinations for Native artists and Native art collectors. This year, a new rival market, the Indigenous Fine Arts Market, will also take place in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For artists, tourists, and the city, the split could mean more money and big rewards for the local economy. Santa Fe Mayor Javier Gonzalez says the city is big enough for two Indian art markets.
It's a very good thing for the city. Any time that we can expand our markets to include more artists and give them venues to be able to sell their artwork, it's great for them, it's good for the city, and it's really good for our visitors who come in and want to experience wonderful artwork.
In past years, Indian Market has brought in nearly 175,000 people. Mayor Gonzalez says the new market will complement city goals for increasing tourism and supporting artists. During this week in 1999, a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the Alaska Native Heritage Center took place in Anchorage, Alaska. The center shares the rich heritage of Alaska Native people. For National Native News, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, with funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, and this is Pat Moore. I'm your host today for Juneau Afternoon. I get the great privilege of introducing a guy who does a lot of volunteer work and a lot of personal work to help people out. Tristan Knutson-Lombardo is here with me, and he's going to tell us a little bit about some programming and events that are set up for ORCA, which is a part of SAIL.
It's one of
Southeast
SAIL's
Alaska
programs.
Independent Living Organization.
Yeah.
And you do a lot of work with the outdoors, getting folks into the outdoors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my fortunate, lucky job I have. Yeah. I'm not too tied to my desk, but yeah, SAIL. We're a region-wide nonprofit here in Southeast Alaska. We work with seniors and elders throughout the region, as well as and mostly with people with disabilities, all ages, any disability. We have offices here in Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, Haines, and we're a great resource. A lot of people come to us because they either recently have acquired a disability, or their environment or situation has changed, or they have somebody in their life who has recently become disabled, and they just don't know where to go or what to do. And so we're a great place because if we can't help directly, we know who can, and we can make sure we work with other people and groups and agencies to get the kind of support and services that somebody might need. So we run a range of programs. We have we help people with transportation. We have a popular taxi voucher program. We have a loan closet of items for people to borrow. We get a lot of walk-in traffic from the hospital. People recently had surgery and they need a wheelchair, crutches, or we have run support groups. We have interpreters for the deaf. We have we do a lot of information and referral. One of our coolest and newest programs, we go into people's homes, and as they're aging and they want to stay in place, stay in the home they're in, we go in and do a survey and say, these are the changes you need to make so that you can live safely and comfortably in your home as you age, and then we work with them on actually making it happen. And then, of course, the ORCA program, my favorite personal favorite program.
What's ORCA stand for?
Outdoor Recreation and Community Access.
There
and,
you go.
Yeah, and so we're a year-round recreation program, an adaptive sports program, and we work with anyone, regardless of their disability or abilities, and we make sure they can get out and ski and snowboard in the winter, go kayaking in the summer, camping, biking, whatever it is they want to do, fishing. We have a lot of seniors in this community like to go out and fish. We have a lot of people who used to be commercial fishermen and women, and they might not do it commercially anymore, but they like to get out every once in a while and cast a line. So we make sure that they can do that. That happens. There's a lot we do. A lot.
What's the funding source for SAIL and ORCA?
We have a really diverse range of funding. We get some local, state, and federal grants. But we also have a lot of private donors, just individuals that donate to us each year. Some local foundations. And then we have a couple of fundraisers. Actually, one of them is sort of coming up. The Only Fools Run at Midnight happens every spring around this, or summer around the solstice. So people will start seeing information pop up about that soon.
Time to start designing costumes.
Yeah, some people have already talked to me about their costumes they're designing. And this year actually will be the 30th annual time event here in Juneau.
Oh, really?
So it hasn't been it's been with SAIL, I think, about 12 years. Before that, it was the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and before that, it was the Volunteer Fire Department had put it on. So, anyway, 30 years, it's a big, long-running event.
And that's one of your fundraisers.
It is. We have an auction in the fall. And then another fundraiser we have is coming up which I can see you're leading me into it, is our annual spring wildlife cruise.
Well, I thought we might mention it since it's,
that was the point. So next weekend.
The boat's already full, right? Nobody's getting on at this point.
Right? it's getting there, actually.
Yeah, it always is, yeah.
We're a little over half full at this point. We're a week out. It's next Saturday. Alan Marina has been a great supporter of us over the years, and so if you are interested in getting tickets, it's Saturday, May 17th, noon to 3. It's only $45. It's a great deal, and it goes to support a great cause. And knock on wood, but for the last five years, we've seen orcas on the orca whale watching cruise. Mm-hmm. So maybe I just jinxed it, but maybe not.
Yeah, it'll work.
Yeah.
We're sure seeing humpbacks right now.
Oh, yeah, we are. Yeah. So people can stop by our office. We're down by the hospital, or they can hop onto our website, sailinc.org, sailinc.org, to get tickets. So,
what's the cost?
$45. So it's a
reasonable.
Pretty good deal.
Yeah, it's a gift.
It's a great time.
And there's still room on the boat.
As of now, there's still room on the boat. So
and the money goes to fill that closet and do all of those services that you listed out.
Exactly,
An amazing organization. We're lucky, to have that. Is this, common around the United States? Do other communities have this kind of service?
That's actually a great question. So we are what's called an independent living center, and there are independent living centers all over the U.S. and communities throughout the U.S. I think that they're – it's around 500 independent living centers. Alaska has, there's three different agencies, but there's offices throughout the state, actually. The interesting thing about the independent living movement is it's a civil rights movement from the 60s and 70s through the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1991. And part of it was a federal mandate that these centers become established. And it's cool, at least 51% of our board and our staff are people with disabilities, which is neat. So it's really driven by the people. We respond to needs in the communities that we serve. If we notice there are gaps or people come to us saying this is an issue, we work with them and work with the community to solve that issue.
I think it's critical. You said when you started talking about that, it doesn't matter what the disability is.
Mm-hmm.
I, there's probably a preconception that you have to be wheelchair bound or something
right.
like that to receive ORCA services. And that's really not true.
It's not true.
Who is it who said we're all disabled? It's just you can see it on some people.
Well, and there's somebody else who likes to say that she likes SAIL because you may not need it now, but you might need it later, especially as you get older. And it's true. And the really neat thing about SAIL, I think, is that just to come in for help, you don't have to have a documented disability. You need to just acknowledge that you have some sort of disability. And, yeah, for some people, I mean, there are a lot of disabilities that we don't see just by looking at somebody. And statistically, about 1 in 5 Americans have a disability. So that's 20% of the population. That's a lot of people. So if you're in a crowded room, 1 in 5 of those people are – there's a good chance we'll have some sort of disability. And disabilities like MS, those are ones that you really wouldn't know somebody had unless you knew them personally or intimately. So it's a great thing in that way that, people think of wheelchairs or somebody being blind or – but it really is wide-ranging.
Lots of people can take advantage of it and support it, which is really the critical thing of our message today.
Mm-hmm.
You have a spring picnic coming up the end of the month, you said?
We do, yeah. So May 31st out at Sandy Beach, and you'll start seeing advertising for that shortly here is our annual spring picnic. And we invite anyone who's had received services from us or still receive services, their family, their friends are welcome to attend. We invite anyone who's donated to us, anybody with a connection to SAIL. So maybe you're a partner agency or somebody, or you just know somebody who's benefited from SAIL services. This is kind of our opportunity to say thank you. Meet as a group. We always provide the grillables, meats, veggie burgers, that kind of stuff. And we'll have lots of fun games and other things, music. And Bob Janes, actually, from Gastineau Guiding, has been working on a unique, adaptive kind of new invention, a recumbent tricycle. And it's part motorized, and then part of it the user can pedal themselves, depending on their abilities and strength and stamina. So he's going to show that off. He has a few models that he's going to bring by, and so people are welcome to try it. So if you or you know somebody who sounds like, boy, we've been trying to figure out how can they get out and exercise based on their strengths, this might be a tool for them to check out. And we'll have a slew of other adaptive bicycles out there, too.
If people don't know what a recumbent bicycle is, this is a bicycle where basically instead of having your feet down below you, you have them out in front of you. So you're sitting in a much different seat, which is much more comfortable for a lot of people who can't sit on a saddle horn anymore.
Yep.
And the interesting thing is that by getting into that position with your legs out in front, you're actually in a terrifically efficient position for the human body to be able to pedal. That's one of the reasons that recumbent bikes are banned from racing, is because they're a lot more efficient than upright bicycles.
Yeah, so, and they're also really stable, too. So for people that have issues
are extremely stable.
Yeah, and your center of mass is lower to the ground. So, it's really beneficial for a lot of people that think biking is out of their realm. I mean, that's our job. We say, if you think you can do it, we're going to find a way to make it happen.
Yeah. Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation and a lot of things to look forward to. But the thing we want to make absolutely certain everybody knows is that next weekend is the Orca Wildlife Cruise.
Yep.
And if you want a seat on that boat, you say you're half full, but it gets tight by Wednesday or Thursday. You're going to have a full boat. So if they want to do this, they need to get on it right now. They can come by the sale office or they can go on the website and get a reservation. It's $45 for the tour and it's 3 hours out where the whales are.
And we're a last minute town.
Hopefully where the orcas are.
Yeah. So hop on it.
Tristan, you obviously like your work. Thank you so much for your enthusiasm. Thank you so much for working on all of these projects and helping folks out.
Appreciate thank you for having me.
You bet.
The KTOO KRNN Spring Auction Live event is happening this Saturday, May 10th from 8 a.m. to noon. Call in to make your final bids on fantastic items from Mountainside Wellness, Coastal Helicopters, Gastineau Guiding, and more. The event is broadcast on KTOO and KRNN Saturday from 8 a.m. to noon. More details at ktoo.org.
This weekend, we're delighted to have the whole panoply of the jazz and classics going on, and it goes on now for another 2 weeks. Here's some music from a group that is going to be in town. Let's see, I think they come in within the next couple, 3 days. This is the Acropolis Reed Quintet. Let's take a listen. The Reed stylings of the Acropolis Winds Quartet, and they'll be in town. Let's see. Their first concert is on Tuesday, May 13th. They're doing a brown bag over at the state office building. Those things are always fun, particularly bring kids. It's really great. They're going to do a workshop for reed instruments. That will also be on Tuesday the 13th. And then they have their major concert at Holy Trinity Episcopal Church on Wednesday, May 14th. So the Acropolis Reed Quintet, one of the Juno Jazz and Classics groups. I have two gentlemen here in the studio with me who are going to tell us about a really interesting and exciting program. You guys are mail carriers, right?
Well, I'm a mail carrier, and he's in charge of the food bank, one of the local food banks.
Okay, and you're Mark Petrowski.
I'm Mark Petrowski.
And you are?
I'm Darren Adams.
Okay, and Darren and Mark, you guys are about to pick up a whole bunch of food, you hope.
Well, yes. We hope.
We've got to get people on this thing now. So everybody got this thing in the mail like a week ago, right?
Everybody should have got a flyer in the mail or a P.O. box that states that we're doing it this Saturday. It'd be just like if you go mail a letter, just put a can of food or a bag of food by your mailbox, And all you have to do is put the flag up, and we do the rest for you. We send it to a local food bank, which is Southeast Alaska Food Bank, as well as Helping Hands. We divide the food up between both of them, try to give everybody a chance to get the food. And it stays here locally. And this is our 22nd annual food drive, but this is the seventh year I've been the food drive coordinator for the Stamp Out Hunger food drive. And it's nationwide, and it always happens the second Saturday of May. And we have, at the Postal Service, we have over 16,000 delivery points. So just think, if 16,000 people that receive mail here in Juneau put a can of food, 16,000 cans of food, so that would be amazing.
There's
wonderful
potential here. You've asked, I believe, that people not put glass.
Yes, please. Yeah, no glass items and non-perishable food items. You know, something that's in your cupboard. And a tip for mothers for Mother's Day, it's a good day to clean out your cupboards.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
So if you clean out all your cupboards and stuff, then there's no food in the cupboards for a Sunday dinner, so they have to take you out for dinner.
This reasoning is impeccable.
It's impeccable.
Mark, exactly.
Yeah. So, yes, and the mail carriers are awesome because they're doing a little bit of extra work. They're carrying a little bit heavier bags, picking up people's food and stuff. And it's going all to the local food banks here. So it's feeding our community here. And it's the, like I said, the largest one-day food drive in America. And this happens across the nation. And I'm glad to be a part of it. And the mail carriers at work, as well as the mail clerks that probably be accepting the food over the counter. You know, if you go to the P.O. box and you don't have a mailbox, you can just give it to the mail clerks at the post office. Or you can drop them off at any of the local food grocery stores, which is IGA, Walmart, Fred Meyer, Safeway, and Super Bear. And there's also a tub at Rainbow Foods to donate food there if you don't want your mail carrier to stress themselves by carrying some of the food. But it's good to get them all involved and get the community involved to feed our kids during the summer, because during the summer months, the food banks get real low.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, I've been at the Southeast Food Bank for approximately 9 years, and it's amazing how generous of a community we live in. However, there are times when you need to remind people that, you know, hunger exists 12 months out of the year, not just around Thanksgiving or Christmas when most people think about, you know, donating to whatever cause. And this program is great because, like Mark said, it's a great excuse to do some spring cleaning, figure out what you bought a case of at Costco that you can live without a couple cans. And, you know, I tell people if they open up their pantries and reach all the way into the back and find that item or two that will never see the light of day, that could be someone's dinner.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's true. That's so true. And it's, like I said, just clean out the cupboards. And you don't have to walk far. You just go straight to your mailbox. I mean, you don't have to get in your car or just, you know.
So if you get your mail at the post office again, what do you do?
If you get your mail at the post office, you could, like I said, drop your food off at any of the grocery stores. Or you could drop it off at the post office
okay, so
on
there's
Saturday.
A collection bucket.
There'll be a hamper out in front of all the post offices. When you go shopping at Fred Meyer's or Super Bear or one of the grocery stores, mm-hmm. and you get that buy two get one free, you can always drop that free one in the in the hamper at the grocery store. And it's amazing how the community's helping us get the word out, as well as, you know, hopefully we'll get our goal. We're trying to shoot for at least 6,000 pounds, you know, this year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to go way over that, but we can get the word out and everybody knows about it, and we can collect a lot of food for Southeast Alaska Food Bank, as well as Helping Hands. And I just want to thank you guys for helping us get this word out.
And if I could mention, I'm allowed to accept any non-perishable food item.
Oh, okay.
Someone would want to donate, with the exception of homemade items.
Okay.
Like if
so
someone does up some smoked salmon or jams or jellies or whatever, I can't take those. I also cannot take outdated baby food, but you know, I can accept anything else non-perishable that someone has their heart set on donating, including like diapers and cleaning supplies and just stuff that you would find in a grocery store.
Okay, and if someone wants to give that, how do they give it?
I would say you know, I don't see a problem with leaving your food donations.
We would pick up, the food donations, and if they put like a box of diapers there too, we would pick that up as well.
Yeah.
Our main concern is, getting the food and stuff, and there is like a lot of children out there that the diapers are very expensive for families and stuff like that. And our goal is to feed the community during the summer months. Like these kids, during the school year, they're eating breakfast and lunch at school, so the family's not really having to buy as much groceries because their child's getting breakfast and lunch at school. But during the summer months, and that they're not going to school, so there's more cost of food for family members and to feed the ones that normally get food at school, at home. So it's a good event, and it helps stock up the...
And it's a fun event. It's a community event. We'll have Boy Scouts out there. We'll have Lions Club members out there. We'll have different groups helping us sort
the food out once it gets to the men's
shelves and all that.
Yeah, so the food's going to be collected by the mail carriers, on Saturday before the mail carrier gets there. So have your food out there before he gets there. And he'll pick it up and bring it to the... post office, and then we transport it from the federal building and from Douglas and from Ott Bay. It all goes to Mendenhall, and then we transport there, and then from Mendenhall we divide it all up and weigh it and see how much we collected of food and non-perishable food items, for these food banks here locally. So it's a community thing that hopefully everybody get involved, and it's easy to get involved. Like I said, all you have to do is go check your mail today, and while you're going to check your mail today, bring that can of soup out there or a bag of rice or a box of cereal or something, and you could put it inside your mailbox. And try not to leave it there overnight because the ravens do get hungry.
Yeah.
So if you have to, try to set it out there before your mail carrier gets there. And a lot of mail carriers on Saturday come by real early in the morning in the valley area. And so if you miss your mail carrier and he's already brought your mail in there, you still can donate. You still can take it to the post office or to any of those grocery stores I mentioned that are trying to help us out.
Outstanding. So it's Fill a Bag, Feed Families, the mail carrier's food drive on Saturday. That's tomorrow. Put the stuff out tonight, but don't leave it out in the mailbox overnight. But first thing in the morning, and your mail carrier will pick it up and take it away. If you miss the pickup, then take it over to Fred Meyer, take it to any of the grocery stores in town,
drop it
in the bucket,
right,
or swing by the post office, and there'll be a hamper out there to pick it up.
And right. I'd just like to thank everyone in advance for your generosity.
Well, thank you for all of the work you guys are obviously putting into this thing.
Well, thanks, Pete, for all your help.
You
appreciate
bet.
It.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 9th of May, 2014. It's the birthday of the poet Ellen Bryant Voigt, born in Danville, Virginia, 1943, who said, "Resist any temptation to use the poem to make its readers like you or admire you or forgive you." It's the birthday of the poet Mona Van Dyne, born in Waterloo, Iowa, 1921, who said, "I believe that good poetry can be as ornate as a cathedral or as bare as a potting shed as long as it confronts the self with honesty and fullness. Nobody is born with the capacity to perform this act of confrontation in poetry or anywhere else. One's writing career is simply a continuing effort to increase one's skill at it." Today is the 80th birthday of playwright Alan Bennett, born in Leeds, England, 1934. Who said, "It's partly sentimental, I'm sure, but it's also partly the way of talking. I've always thought this. The Yorkshire and Lancashire way of talking is inherently dramatic. I think it's a Germanic thing, but the point of a sentence is often kept till the end, which is ideal for comedy writing." Alan Bennett, who went off to Oxford, became part of a satiric troupe there called Beyond the Fringe. It was a huge success. He wrote a series of dramatic monologues for television called Talking Heads. Ordinary people talking, an alcoholic vicar's wife who has an affair with an immigrant grocer, author of screenplays, The Madness of King George III, The History Boys, many plays, and his most recent book, a prose work called Smut, Two Unseemly Stories, that came out 2 years ago. Here's a poem for today, actually several little poems, children's poems collected by the folklorist Scott Hastings Jr. in a book called Miss Mary Mac, All Dressed in Black. Early one morning, late at night, two dead boys went out for a fight. Back to back they faced each other, drew their swords and shot each other. A deaf policeman heard their noise and came and shot the two dead boys. If you don't believe this lie is true, go ask the blind man. He saw it too. Peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold, peas porridge in the pot, 9 days old. Some like it hot, some like it cold, some like it in the pot, 9 days old. Great green gobs of gooey grimy gopher guts, mutilated monkey meat, little dirty birdie feet, French fried eyeballs swimming in a pool of blood. I forgot my spoon, but I have a straw. Seal sandwich, pus on top, monkey's vomit, camel snot, rabbit eyeballs dipped in glue, yum, yum. It's good for you. Nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. Guess I'll go eat worms. Long, skinny, slimy worms, big, fat, juicy worms. Oh, how I love worms. First one was easy, second one was greasy, third and fourth went down easy, fifth got stuck, and the sixth came up. Oh, how I hate worms. Children's Rhymes from Miss Mary Mac, All Dressed in Black, collected by folklorist Scott E. Hastings, Jr., and published by August House. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today. My next guest is coming to us by telephone from, overlooking beautiful Kachemak Bay down in Homer. Michael McBride has just recently released a book called The Last Wilderness, Alaska's Rugged Coast, and it tells a fascinating story of he and his wife and their children as they sort of refurbished a miner's or an early cabin on the one on the far side of Kachemak Bay and turned it into a wonderful lodge that's had visitors throughout the years. Welcome, Michael.
It's great to be here. It's great to be talking to you and Juno on such a beautiful day in Kachemak Bay. I bet it's the same there.
We have had such a lovely run of sunny days that it's almost worth a public celebration. And I'm looking over my shoulder here at the weather forecast, and it's supposed to cloud up a little bit tomorrow. But we're supposed to have at least cloudy conditions, but no rain through the rest of the week into Wednesday of in the middle of next week. So it's been just absolutely stunning so far this summer down here.
Well, great. For you and all your friends, I'm sure you deserve every minute of it.
So there are really two parts to this book. The first is this story that is interleaved all the way through it of you and your wife when you were very young, first of all, and then as you gradually built the lodge up and began receiving visitors and all that sort of stuff. But then the second part of it is this role that you almost decried having to play yourself of environmental protection because it had you were really one of the first ecotourism operations in the state at a time when tourism of Alaska usually consisted of being equipped with something that would either shoot or catch fish, and you were doing a lot more with cameras at the time. So there's a real shift here in the focus at an early time, and I congratulate you for having kind of done that before the wave, as it were.
Well, it's been a marvelous 45 years, I can assure you that, and the environmental struggles or battles or efforts notwithstanding, to live in such a glorious place, so bountiful in visual glory and marine diversity and so forth. A person just couldn't be luckier than to have spent a lifetime here. And your descriptions of the second stage of our lives, of being caught up in all sorts of efforts to encourage people to take care of this bounty that we so freely enjoy from the marine ecosystem, you know, those were not things that we sought out, but repeatedly, for example, the sale of all of Ketchumak Bay, now a critical habitat area, the sale of that area for oil leases in 1976, and then becoming a plaintiff in a Supreme Court lawsuit to reverse that and to force the state to buy back $25 million worth of leases right here in Ketchumak Bay, which would have resulted in the Homer Spit becoming an industrial area and would have enormously changed what's happened here in this community. But in any case, when one lives in a place of great beauty and great natural productivity, it just sort of comes hand in glove that other forces will potentially, possibly work against that continued productivity, and one just needs to do what one can to help the policy and decision makers and children to, at the same time, understand the value and the integrity of sustainable interaction with the natural world in order that it'll keep doing for us what it's been doing, namely providing beautifully for us.
I think right at the very beginning of the last chapter of the book, if I could read from it, you captured this thing that I keep trying to come around, because it's really the horn of the dilemma that we all sit on in the state of Alaska. You wrote, "With their fellows around the world who are keepers of wild areas, Alaskans and other Americans share the difficult challenge of balancing the need for resource extraction with the values of wilderness. The money from logging, oil, fish, and minerals is needed to fund schools, roads, and the myriad of public needs. Too often in Alaska and elsewhere, decision makers have come to believe that the debate is an either-or struggle. In our global community and information age, we can and must learn to understand and appreciate the diverse values of wilderness. As I write this, the World Bank is engaged in a major study verifying that ecotourism has positive impacts on economic systems far beyond the face value of money injected into the grassroots levels of the areas. Investment portfolios structured with an eye towards sustainability have increasingly come to consider the financial value of wilderness." I think that gets at the economic question, which is a long ways from the pictures that are on the outside cover of the book of the beauty of the area that you're in. But I think that's the place where all of us who've lived in Alaska for any length of time are sitting.
Well, you know, it's not just an Alaska dilemma, though. Alaska, by virtue of its richness in various kinds of natural resources, be it fish or timber or oil or coal, I think it's heavily incumbent upon Alaskans to understand these issues in order that they can help guide the political process. Because if the average guy on the street doesn't understand that that burning coal, for example, is so injurious to the ocean and to the fisheries on which we depend, we're in deep trouble unless the average person spends a little time and energy becoming familiar with the carbon cycle and how it works. It's not too big a step from there to go to ocean acidification, which I didn't talk much about in the book, but which I forecast will be the most important conversational subject for Alaskans in the very near future, because our burning of fossil fuels all over the world is increasing ocean acidification, which challenges the whole marine ecosystem, which obviously includes whale and plankton and seals and salmon. So being conversant in that subject area, even though we are, as you say, on the horns of a dilemma here, an international dilemma, is all any of us can do is to, first of all, try to be well-informed, and second of all, do the kindness to share it with your children and your neighbor, and most importantly, with your elected representatives, because they certainly have a disproportionate share of influence over what happens at Pebble or what happens with coal extraction being accelerated in Cook Inlet and so forth. So there's great optimism. I mean, we stand at a beautiful and a wonderful crossroad that we have all manner of technological skills, and I think we have an increasingly literate populace who is increasingly able to understand the carbon cycle and basic chemistry, and I think are increasingly willing to help their legislators in a positive way instead of having an adversarial relationship with our policy and decision makers, with helping them to understand the real value, as you just read in terms of the World Bank study, the real economic value of taking care of this place as opposed to the short-sighted resource extraction that is not geared toward the long-term future.
I certainly think there's great wisdom in what you're saying. I have a personal question for you. Throughout your book, you talk about the fact that you have always kind of gone to the wilderness in order to refresh yourself and to get your head clear and to find your way. Do you still do that now that you've moved back across the bay?
You bet your booties. it's my flesh and blood. It's the breath that I breathe. I live surrounded by it. For the last hour before receiving your call, I was back in the woods getting my spring running and being back in the woods. Well, you know, throughout human history, all for a minute we could diverge on this trail and talk about religions. All of the world's great religious leaders or spiritual counselors talk about the value of immersing yourself in wilderness. Well, I maintain that wilderness is available around the corner or around the block from anybody, even if you live in a city. You can go to the nearest patch of grass and lay on your belly and watch ants or bugs, or lay on your back and watch the clouds, or just simply close your eyes and go deep in your own heart. And each of those are wildernesses. One doesn't have to live far from the end of the road, like I do purposefully, to be immersed in wilderness. And I think I've used the word religion because I think this subject really is spiritual. How we are or aren't taking care of this planet that we've been given by some great force has everything to do with spirituality and has everything to do with religions, given that a huge percentage of the world's population share a religious perception of things. And in that language or in those realms, we have the opportunity and the responsibility to take care of this amazing thing. And I think it's philosophical, it's spiritual, and it's practical. And let's throw in the fact that it's great fun. I think for any of us, if we're in a doom and gloom mode, oh my God, the oceans are rising and there's not enough food and we're fouling the ocean, end of conversation. There has to be optimism, there has to be enthusiasm, there has to be excitement about what's in front of us in terms of the opportunities that lie within our reach.
There are great challenges and great opportunities. Thank you for bringing the story of some of the great opportunities that you took advantage of when you were young enjoying Alaska, and telling us the story of your life in The Last Wilderness, Alaska's Rugged Coast by Michael McBride. It's out right now. The book is for sale here in Juneau. It's also for sale, I imagine, around the country, and it's well worth the read. Thank you very much for joining us today, Michael.
Thank you, Pat. It was terrific.
This is Bird Note.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars.
Ever thought of flying to the moon? You'd need to buckle up for a flight of 239,000 miles. That's roughly the same as circling the Earth 10 times. But you still wouldn't have flown as far as a red knot that was named B-95. This male sandpiper was first banded in 1995. Now, red knots migrate about 16,000 miles round trip each year. They nest above the Arctic Circle and winter near the tip of South America. That means B-95's cumulative migration flights would have carried him to the moon, and he'd already be on his way back. In spite of the bird's astonishing abilities, red knot populations have declined severely in recent decades. The migrating birds rely on critical resting and feeding areas such as Delaware Bay. In South America, conservation groups, including the international organization RARE and the Manomet Center, are helping protect three crucial wintering sites in Argentina. Red knots and other long-distance travelers deserve and depend upon healthy coastal ecosystems throughout the Western Hemisphere. To take a look at programs working on their behalf, begin at birdnote.org.
Well, let's see. It's coming up on Mother's Day is the 11th, right? So I've got a guy here who's going to tell us about something that you can do for mom or for just about anybody. Darren Snyder is here, cooperative extension agent for Juno, and Darren is going to tell us about a little opportunity that we have tomorrow morning.
Yeah,
at 8 o'clock.
It's a super opportunity, and you just heard 8 o'clock from Pat, but really that's
9, I guess.
Yeah. So the ribbons.
It's 8 for me because I have to go help set up.
Right. Yeah. So the ribbons drop at 9 a.m. at the Safeway parking lot tomorrow morning. It's the super plant sale. It's been going on for years. Those of you in the garden community are well aware of it and look forward to it each year. Those of you new to the community, come on out. This is really, honestly, the preeminent opportunity for getting things that work, talking to folks who know how to grow plants from anything from the Juno Community Garden. Various master gardeners are going to be throughout the area. 4-H has a booth out there, as well as the Jensen Olson Arboretum and many others, selling all kinds of excellent plants for our region. There are also some commercial vendors, Ed's Edibles, Ed Byarski, and David Lindrum with Landscape Alaska. They're selling various plants, both edibles and ornamentals throughout. As well, we have some smaller folks. Aaliyah Oyen is there, and she's just a gardener in town. She's got poppies and she's got some vegetable starts. But this is definitely the place to get a lot of great things that work in Juno. There's even some folks out there. There are some folks who have built some garden boxes. And if you're new to Juno, you may not be aware, but we garden above ground here because that's the way that you can heat up your soil a lot easier by the sun, and it's not in the cool earth, and it also gets better drainage. So these folks are selling some boxes they've pre-built, and it's for a good cause. And tomorrow at 9 a.m., 9 until noon, but get there early to get your best choices at the Safeway parking lot. That's the best time.
I want to expand on this business of what works here.
Yeah.
Because critically, a lot of people who are new to the area or who haven't gardened much up here don't realize that we are like a couple of climate zones north of where most of the gardening books are talking about. So
yeah, most of the time.
It's not a simple matter to throw seeds in the ground and cause things to grow up here. It's a little bit more difficult.
And even our zone, if you look in the books and you see, okay, well, maybe zone 3 to 5 or so, It's a little misleading because our temperatures are more moderate than our conditions. Our conditions are, we have some pretty extreme freeze-thaw that our plants have to go through. We, of course, are up here in the northern latitudes, so we have a very shortened summer with the long days, thank goodness. Any of your annuals have to be, started on time and by now. And these are, you can purchase some starts at the garden sale tomorrow morning.
So we actually put those starts, yeah. I'm raising a rack of them at home,
nice.
And we actually put those starts in March.
Yeah.
They're now, they're wonderful. Mm-hmm. I have plants 4, 5, 6 inches high that we've been raising under lights during this time.
Yeah.
And about, I guess a week or so ago, we started moving them out during the day. We have them on these rolling racks so we can run them out in the driveway and harden them off.
Yeah.
So now they're used to it. They're, these plants are sitting there saying, plant me, grow me.
Yeah.
They're ready. They're ready to go in the ground.
And those are the annuals, mostly vegetables, but also ornamental flowers and such for the annuals. But we have, at the 4-H booth, we have perennials that are definitely proven varieties, and they're called bare root. They're shipped up here, again, from very proven sources, and they have been sweated. That means that their buds are already formed and they're ready to grow. So you just need to prepare a spot in your yard and put these in. We have a really nice brochure. So just stop by the 4-H booth and we'll give you the brochure with almost 20 different varieties of mostly ornamental but some edible plants there. We've got a couple varieties of cherries. And your standbys, as in the rugosa roses, both white and red, some of the forsythias and maples, and lots of good plants there. And I heard from Sandy Williams and the other folks at the Juneau Community Garden, which is what Pat, you and your wife Dolores help out with, and that you guys have like something like 1,500 or 2,000 starts that you're selling there. So this is a big deal, folks. So any gardeners out there or somebody who wants to put together something nice for your mother or your wife or family activity or mothers, do it for yourselves. You can come on out and get some of the great plants that are available out there at the plant sale.
Outstanding. So the sale begins at 9:00 tomorrow morning at Safeway parking lot.
Yep.
There will be a lot of different exhibitors there. There's plenty of parking, not a real problem there. But I will warn everybody that this thing moves fairly quickly. This is an amazingly fast plant sale. So if you have your eye on something particularly that you want to be there at 0900, folks.
Yeah.
9:00 for those of you that don't do the 24-hour clock. But because I can tell you right now from past experience, by 10:00, it's going to look like the apocalypse hit that place. The shelves will be half empty. So it's people know about this, and they come out every year and do the thing. We're going to have great weather for it, by the way.
Awesome.
The latest forecast that I've got here, it'll probably be updated. There it is. So Saturday's forecast is mostly sunny, highs around 65 with light winds becoming southwest 10 in the afternoon. It's going to be so nice out there compared to some of the previous years.
I think
we had a hurricane one year. It was amazing.
Last year was pretty wet and chilly.
Yeah, wet and chilly. But this one is going to be short sleeve shirt weather. So everybody's going to have a good time at this little number. Somebody ought to set up a lemonade stand. Darren, thank you so much. Thank you so much for all of the work that you do as the extension agent as well, promoting agriculture and gardening here in Juneau and many other activities as well.
You're welcome, Pat. Thank you.
You bet.
I'm right on the brink. I'm tired of wearing a smile. Looking up at the sky, baby, I'm that storm rolling up on you, right on the brink. Right on the brink, baby. Right on the brink. Yeah, I'm so tired of
this lady sing, too. Nikki Hill is here in the studio with me. Welcome to Juno.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Nikki's one of the artists in the Juno Jazz and Classics this year, and that demure, quiet little voice of yours. you really hold back a lot.
You know me.
Well, I'm glad to meet you, I have to say, because I've been listening to your music here for weeks. You got some style.
Thanks so much.
I love the way that sounds.
Thank you. It's a fun record.
did you come in through like gospel music, or where did your?
I did.
It shows.
Most little kids in the South, I grew up singing in the gospel choirs as a kid. Probably started around 6 years old or so.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, at the time, it was funny. You feel kind of forced into it because your parents make you go and make you do it, and now years later, of course, I appreciate it a lot. But you know, even at the time, I always had a great time doing it. It was great vocal training. It was great showmanship training. When I first started singing, the church didn't have any instruments or anything, so there was a lot of vocal harmonies, a lot of, you know, vocal dynamics and stuff. So it was a great experience, definitely, and I do have to attribute that to pretty much the way I sing now.
So, obviously, you had to make a transition. You're what, 27, 28 years old? You haven't been doing this very long, but man, you have this wonderful maturity to your voice and to the way
you
deliver
a
lyric.
Thank you. Yeah, it's when I stopped singing in the choir, I was went through my, I guess, rebellion phase, although I don't think it was that rebellious, but, you know, cut my hair, dyed it green, started listening to, you know, a bunch of punk rock and roll and stuff like that, and then that became an even more driving force of the music that I really enjoyed and the music that I like to sing. But one thing that I always did notice was, especially the type of music that I sang in the church I grew up in, it was just as energetic as all the rock and roll that I've listened to or listened to as a teenager. You know, Sister Rosetta Tharpe to me is about as rock and roll as you can get. So it wasn't really that big of a transition, minus the dyeing my hair and ripping my clothes up, you know.
Okay, so now you've opened the door here. So Rosetta Tharpe is obviously somebody, but who are the voices that you hear in your head when you were starting to find yourself?
A big influence for me is definitely Otis Redding. I love Otis Redding. Another kind of gospel-based singer that I love is Mavis Staples, the Staple Singers. I think their blend of soul and gospel and just Pop Staples' tremolo guitar, there's something about that really moves you, you know. And I'm also a huge fan of Bon Scott from AC/DC, so that's probably one of my bigger rock and roll vocal influences, too.
How much does the crowd get you to change what you're doing?
The crowd means everything.
Yeah.
The crowd definitely means everything. I mean, either way, the band and I we're going to put on the show. We're going to go up there and do it the way we do it, but when you're getting a response back, obviously that's going to drive you, you know, so when you step out in front of a big crowd, or you go to a festival and there's 20,000 people, you know, of course you're saying, all right, I really have to deliver, you know, and you're giving them your energy, they're giving you their energy, and it's a beautiful thing. It's an unreal feeling.
Nikki Hill going to be performing tonight at Elizabeth Paratrovich Hall over at the A&B, and then let's see, you got another. You're on the Blues Cruise.
I am on the Blues Cruise.
Mama,
we are ready to party.
You are going to love that. Let me tell you, that's an amazing trip. An amazing trip. So hey, thanks for coming to Juno. Thanks for bringing your voice to Juno, so we can all hear this good sound.
Thank you very much.
You bet. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay. We're tuned on K276 AF 103.1, Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. And Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait here, KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. It's time for All Things Considered.